Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. At this point in a retreat, I just want to tell bedtime stories. My experience is that too much information, you just get kind of overload. Whereas a few ideas, if you just take them and keep hammering away, it seems to be more fruitful. So when I started teaching, I thought I had to give a lot of information. I think people got indigestion. They were very kind, you know. So I'd give all the lists. So now I just talk about one thing, really, awakening. So how about a story? You know, another magical story. You probably, many of you have heard some of this, but we have a monastery in California, Bayagiri. It's a beautiful monastery. It's our biggest monastery in North America. Ajahn Pasano is the abbot. Ajahn Amaro used to be. They were both abbots. It's about 200 acres in Northern California near the town of Ukiah, Redwood Valley. And it's a very very steep site. So it's the kind of the bottom of a it's a sub valley off a larger valley on a road called Tumkai Road, and it's like that. It's like 45 degrees going. It's bad on the knees. And it's a beautiful monastery. And how old is it? 20 years they've been building it. It's been a lot of work, a lot of kutis, maybe 20 kutis. And they've just finished a beautiful meditation hall complex. And I was at the opening in June. So I know the place quite well. And then last year during all these great fires in California, I mean, if what year hasn't been in your last year's fires, Tumkai Road was pretty much destroyed. And when I drove in June, I think I saw 7 or 8 new houses being built, and several people lost their lives. And of course, the monastery is kind of at the end of Tumkai Road. And during the fires, one of the monastery was very afraid the fire would come into the monastery. The monks were very afraid. And one night, one of the Anagarikas woke up in the middle of the night, and the fire was on the ridge above the monastery. So he called the alarm, and they had to run for it. 25 people were in the monastery, monks and lay people. And they couldn't go into Tumkai Road because that was burning, so they had to go back. And the road back up Tumkai Road is it kind of peters out into sort of rock and stuff. They had to go up. There is an exit that way. And I think two of the cars were abandoned and everyone loaded up into the truck. They made it over, and then they went to the City of 10,000 Buddhas, which is a Mahayana monastery, very, very close to Abhayagiri, and actually the land of Abhayagiri was given by Master Shunhua. So they're very good friends, so they ended up there. But all the time, and actually I was in New Hampshire during the fires, Ajahn Pasano was there, and they were really sophisticated watching all the California fire apps that were showing where the fires were moving. It was all around the monastery. And we're all watching Ajahn Pasano. How is he reacting to this one? Very cool, very impressive, very impressive. So they couldn't go in for a few days. And the monastery has quite a large parking lot. And what happened was that the firemen were actually using that for staging to fight the fire. So I think there are 200 firefighters around the property, and they were determined to save it because they had lost so much. And one of the firefighters said that he was, and so the monastery's in a bowl like that, right? And the main buildings are here, and then all around are the kutis, and there's a ring trail kind of halfway up, and most of the kutis are below the ring trail. And one of the firefighters, and these guys are really tough guys, they're not woo-woo types. Woo-woo types. he's up. They're fighting the fire, they're dropping water and all that. And he's on the ring trail, and the fire's coming down, and he saw it come to the ring trail, and then it went back. And he said, like, the fire refused to come down. He'd never seen that. I've never seen that. And I was there, and there was one stream of fire that had come, like, right down. It was all burned and almost reached one of the big water tanks. Hadn't gone that far. So one old kuti was destroyed. The rest was saved. It's just a really magical, magical story. So that's your bedtime story. I'm back to work. Yeah, it's a really stunning story. What you want to make of it, well, then people embellish it, of course, with all kinds of magical devas and so on. I don't know. But the firefighters kind of, I think they really kind of appreciated the monks, because the monks had a very cool head, and they could talk to them and so on. We didn't end up doing any counseling and stuff like that, but the reputation of the monastery is very, very high there. So now that I've done that, maybe I could just approach some of these questions. Could you talk about the subtle form of becoming that is hard to notice in everyday life? Everyday life is gross becoming. Forget about the subtle. Everyday life is like rushing to get this done and rushing to get that done. And mostly the becoming is probably around getting stuff finished. So I should think what you want to do is learn how to do for the sake of doing, rather than for the sake of finishing. That would be the most obvious around bhava tanha. Because you can do things vigorously and fast with the idea of getting them finished, or you can do them vigorously and fast with just the practice of doing vigorous and fast. It's very hard not to get into that trap, getting one thing finished, getting another thing finished. So that's the kind of basic. Like some monasteries, you know, you're probably in the West, we're used to the Mahasi Sayadaw method of walking slowly. So the obvious, you know, the idea is that all Buddhism's slow. Well, some monasteries do fast. Like Zen, some of the Zen monasteries actually do fast, as fast as you can. And I think Ajahn Mahabua, some of his monasteries, they do fast. I do medium. But so the whole kind of, you know, just like if I'm doing, the reason I like to do woodwork is that's one of the very reasons, because I rush to get stuff done. So I use woodwork to develop just a kind of love of skill that I have, but also just that tendency to get to a place where I want to get this finished and then blow it. Make a sloppy job. So actually use that, you know, that aspect in my mind, I know comes up a lot when I'm getting close to a finish. Like I'm very terrible on finishing. Once I've constructed the thing, I think, oh, where's the next one? And yet finishing is what you see. No one sees the construction. And Pavaro is just there finishing. So I use that very, very, because that triggers in my mind this strong sense of wanting to get something finished and so on, and then wrecking it in the sorrow of that. I really try to watch that part of my mind and slow down. focus, concentrate. And that's good for my spiritual life, isn't it? Because that affects me all the ways. But the subtle sense of becoming, that's what you notice when, well, like there's kinds of, say, just like not wanting to be somewhere else, I suppose, is a kind of becoming. Like, let's say you're talking with someone who's very verbose, and you know you've heard what they said two, three, four, five times, and you've done everything. You know, you looked at your watch, and you've moved the cup around, and blah blah blah. So you can be you can say let's finish this now, but for some reason you can't or whatever. Then that, the whole sense of aversion and wanting to do something else, that's a form of, I guess mostly it's aversion, but it's also maybe wanting to go somewhere else. You watch that. You watch that kind of state of mind. But I think in meditation then, like if you've been doing this for a few years and then you do this for a few days, your mind does really settle. And then you see this kind of reaching to an object. Because awareness is not an object. You can't find awareness, you can be aware. But there's this kind of great attachment to objective reality, which we need to do. But even when you sit down, you can see you're looking for awareness. So the whole sense of laying back, letting it come to you, receptive, all the language that modern meditators use. It's very, very appropriate language. So that you notice more in meditation. And then in meditation, if you understand that, then your mind tends to settle really very still. And then that stillness affects you quite profoundly, so that when you become more active, the stillness is a stronger memory, and the stillness shows your tendency to become. You create a contrast. Yeah? But you won't get the refinement of that in ordinary life, because ordinary life is much more coarse. It demands a different kind of energy. But any amount of deep stillness that you experience is going to show you the unnecessary restlessness of the mind, unnecessary becoming. That will become more and more suffering. So the refinement of stillness in meditation gives you more refined attention to coarseness of becoming. You tend to let it go more. And you can see how that's a training which needs to be done in a way where you are in refinement, and then you're in the normal parts of life. Like any kind of training, I guess. Can you say again a bit more about how to work with a strong mind state, like making a big mistake or failure? How to allow it without letting it overwhelm? I think one of the best ways to do that is, well, you have to make it conscious. And one way would be to verbalize it, but not the verbalization of narrative, if you know what I mean. So I make a big mistake. I start a monastery. Oh, no, I shouldn't. I was supposed to retire. Now, let's say we decide to purchase a new truck, say, for the monastery. And we get done, you know, it's a wreck, and we pay $20,000 for it or something like that, you know, and you think, oh God, lay people's money, you idiot. You know, it's a horrible feeling, you know, because the monastery runs on the generosity of lay people, so I'm kind of really cognizant of, you have to use this carefully. So let's say I was the guy that said that, I'm not the guy, I don't make those decisions, but like, if I was, and then I was naive, and then I realize, and then the thing's a real tank of some sort. So now I've got the result. And everyone says, oh, you'll be all right. Oh, it's okay, Bhante, it's okay. Oh, yeah, it's okay for you. So then the narrative will be hopeless, 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 right? And bad monk. But that's thinking which is not mindful. But I mean, and the feeling's very real. And one of the irritating things of life is when people are dismissive about very real things you're feeling. Oh, it'll be all right. Yeah, bloody hell, but it's not all right right now. It's horrible. That's life. So having been dismissed by everyone, and then you even feel more irritated, you one of the things you just got to do is just got to just say it out to yourself, I think. You're a bloody idiot. You're a fool. I just wait. You know, really make it conscious. But don't do that for 5 hours, because then you're not conscious of it. Then you are an idiot. You get what I mean? So, you know, you make it conscious. Oh, boy, you turkey. If you have more florid language, go ahead. But then wait. Oh, yeah, this is a feeling of deep embarrassment. Or, you know, and then it comes, and a strong misunderstanding, maybe. You spoke, you know, you blamed someone, you know, and one of those horrible things where a third party comes to you and they said, you know what, they did this and they did that. You kidding, really? And you bang them and you realize they didn't do anything. So you have that horrible feeling of just dumped on someone who didn't do anything. That's just isn't that horrible? And yet you got to live with it, unless you're into whiskey or something, I don't know. And so then, you know, you have to kind of get away from complexity and just let this thing come up and say, oh, mea culpa, you apologize and all that. But in just the feeling, because what when you do something like that, you don't want the feeling. It's just horrible. So how do you not get the feeling? You hate yourself. Because by thinking, you don't feel, right? So actually, self-flagellation is a really nice thing to do when you hate yourself. Or when you have that kind of memory, because the memory itself is yuck, oh, and everything in the desire system it says, you don't want this. You want history to change, so maybe replay it. But you know, history's not going to change, and so then you have to make it conscious. But not in a, but in the way of Dharma rather than the way of self. So you say it, you know, God, that was dumb, and then stop. You gotta stop, because we can do dumb, 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 but that's not. And then you stop and you feel it, and it comes up again, and you feel it. And that you gotta give yourself time for that. I mean, go off into the washroom at work or whatever you have to do. But you really need space for that, because if you're then immediately after engaged with human relationships, then you're gonna try to be as polite and kind as you can. That's what you're gonna do, because you're a good person. But then when you go back to the space of no one around, it'll come up again. And that's a very important idea. You know, when I talk about making conscious like feelings in the body, I'm also referring to that ability to make something conscious. And these kinds of things are exactly where that works really, really well. Let's say you're you know, with this person who is very whatever. And you want to leave. And so what your mind is saying, well, you shut up, you twit. But you can't because he's the boss or whatever reason. But your mind is saying, you know, you'd like to stick a pie in their face. But you can't. So what do? You act politely. But in back of your mind, you can be very deceitful, very hypocritical. Say, oh, you stupid idiot. Oh, you're very nice. But you can also do that and not be hypocritical, right? You can say, now I wanna really make conscious this resistance I'm having. So you can talk to the person and try to be a decent person, and in your back you might say, why don't you shut up? And then no, oh, that's the feeling. You're doing the same thing now, but you're not hypocritical. You're making conscious the resistance. Will you shut up? And it does work, because we don't we feel so threatened by these things very often, you know, because we don't want them. We're good people. We're not bad people. Oh, we're not We're not psychopaths. We're sensitive and all the rest of it. So these kind of things come up, and the habit is to not feel it fully and run into self-disparagement. At least that's my habit, has been. I mean, I'm better at it, obviously. But or just carry it around as an underlying resentment and then explode somewhere else. But if in the middle of it you can just say the words of what it is, and then stop. Oh, and then you know, oh yeah, this is the feeling. Okay, I've got it. And then you have to be very, very patient. And you're not even trying to fix it, but you're not going there in the sense that you're not believing it, but it is there because of the conditioning of the mind. With this as condition that arises. When there's this, there's that. This not being that does not arise. When there's not this, there's not that. Dependent origination. And that's the way that Theravada Buddhism tries to deal with this whole strong sense of me and mine and mistakes and so on. It's very good. It works very, very well. But you could misuse it by just then running on and thinking, you know, horrible thoughts about yourself. You can do other things, like, so you make a big mistake or a failure. You could say to yourself, it wasn't a failure. Doesn't work, does it? Right? Others can say to you, no, it wasn't a failure. It's perfectly okay. It helps a little bit. Doesn't work. Because if you feel it's a failure at some level, right? And if you make that conscious, so you're hopeless, then you have the space of awareness. If you don't make it conscious, it eats away in the background of your consciousness and becomes a belief system. Right? Now, if you're a psychopath and this doesn't come up, it's not a problem. If you're totally like kind of domineering, arrogant and so on, it's not a problem that comes up, but you know. We're not that way, you know. We're sensitive, good people, and people can say to you, "Oh, failures are natural, mistakes are natural." So it gets very kind of smarmy, but it can be very dismissive. Whereas if someone says to you, "Wow, yeah, that must be hard to be aware of," that's I find much more helpful because it's not dismissing your suffering, with an attempt to make them feel different. That's what we do. Well, as I think what was more skillful is if we let them know what their feeling is, that's what I think talking can do, right? And we say, so yeah, what does it feel like? Where is it in your body? Is it really tense? So we're good at that. Our cultures, this kind of psychology culture is good at that. So we can do that for ourselves. That makes sense, yeah? So you speak of experiencing changing with hearing and unchanging with experiencing sensations in the hands. What is the difference? I wonder because I experience constant changing sensation in my hands, and when I place my attention and awareness, when I place my attention there and awareness is present. Well, I'm just suggesting that awareness is unchanging. You know, when I say listen to sound and feel your hands, both of those are changing. The sense doors are different. But what's unchanging is awareness, because awareness has no quality. Awareness knows. That's what those two suggestions. This is in awareness, and you move back and forth. There is something that knows. And that knowing was the same as for both sense doors. At least that's the way I experience it. So you notice change. To notice change, you have to disengage from the emotion or the sound. You have to be aware of it, but you cannot be preoccupied by it. That's the idea. If you're not preoccupied by it, you'll notice that that very awareness contains everything, is here, and yet it is nowhere You get these kind of enigmatic statements around awareness. Can't really describe it. So you have the analogies, the vase and the flowers, the space and form, background, foreground, these different ways that we talk about it. And in trying to connect up the teaching to my experience, I get confused about the relationship of greed, hatred, and delusion to the three types of craving. The responses of non-becoming, non-preoccupation, and non-resistance seem to apply to both. Are they the same? Well, there's kind of many ways of talking in the Theravada text, the kind of, it's kind of like a looking at a problem from different angles. So the greed, hatred, and delusion is one of the ways you look at it. And the three types of craving are another way to look at it. And when I talk about those non-becoming, non-preoccupation, non-resistance, I'm talking about the three types of craving. And you can see how greed can be both filled with, you know, greed. I can be greedy and know greed as an object, or I can be greedy and deluded at the same time. You know, both running at the same time. So delusion, in this sense, is basically not seeing that, like, that what arises ceases is an object in consciousness, and believing that I own it, or believing that in the unchanging I can find, in change I can find permanency, or in that which is changing all the time I'll find myself. So the nature of greed is that it creates both aversion. I don't want this thing, but I want this other thing. Right? So when you're greedy for something, you can have both aversion and becoming in there, operating. What do I want? Let's say I'm at the food line and there's two pieces of blueberry pie left, and I'm fourth in line, right? So I'm gonna be looking at the blueberry pie with greed, and hoping two people drop dead in front of me. As if you're a psychopath, right? So, but greed, hatred, and delusion are the way we talk about the roots of our wrong engagement with sense experience. And delusion is like when you really believe in greed, then you're really deluded. If you just, like, if you really think that by getting that next thing you're going to be happy, and then you have buyer's remorse, and then you buy again, and then you have buyer's remorse. That's delusion. But if you buy something and you know, yeah, you'll probably want to return it soon, but anyway, let's go for it, then you're okay. You know how the mind works. Rather than think you can never buy anything. But I take, so those are the roots. But what I find most interesting and helpful in kind of moment-by-moment consciousness is really from the Four Noble Truths, is the nature of craving, because that connects me to what we call dependent origination. So with contact, there's feeling with feeling, there's craving with craving, there's attachment and becoming, and so on. So constantly in my stream of consciousness, there are contacts being made with memories, with objects, with sights and sounds and bodily feelings, and that's has this component of feeling in it. It feels attractive, or it feels not attractive, repulsive, or neutral, And then the craving is operating around those feelings, trying to maximize the pleasure and trying to minimize the displeasure. It's the way it's working. And really that's where you break the cycles of birth and death or suffering, is in contact, feeling, craving, and attachment. That's what we talk about a lot. And ignorance of that just keeps it spinning around. And what ignorance of that is the whole self-narrative prevents you from seeing it. So what prevents me from seeing my habit of self-disparagement is believing in it, believing that I am a terrible person. What allows me to break the cycle is that with memory as condition, so let's say I made this dumb mistake 3 weeks ago, and I've sort of gotten over it, and then a nice truck comes in to the monastery, which only cost $10,000. And I see it, and that strikes a memory. So with contact as condition, there's a feeling. And the feeling now is not really about the truck, it's about the my truck and the truck I bought, right? And with that contact, there's a feeling of unpleasantness, because I'm comparing. And with that unpleasantness, there's the craving to have that truck, and there's also the craving not to have my own personal history. I wish I hadn't done that. And with that craving, what arises is a story. Idiot. And then the guy, he says, hey, you see this truck? 8,000, actually. With contact as condition, 8,000, just a sound. That's all it is, just 8,000, just sound. But it is loaded with meaning because I'm working with 20,000 in a car that doesn't work. So with contact, there is a feeling, oh. And with that feeling, I don't want that ugly feeling. So there's a craving to somehow rectify that. What do? I go into self-hatred, into my own history, but that's where I can break it. That's where I can break it. So Chuck comes in, I look at it, and there's a memory. Memory feels this way. And I see my truck, and I see his truck, and I feel horrible. And then I can say to myself, you are pathetic. But now I'm full consciousness, right? And then I stop. And it's like I say, you know, like bring your attention to your knee, and then just wait. And then all of a sudden comes along, isn't it? Same kind of thing. And now, and then all these ideas of this is inner awareness. And then you as you get used to that, and this feeling is changing, but the unchanging is the knowing. You would say, oh, that's my refuge. There's no refuge in thought and all that. And certainly I can, you know, make decisions never to buy another truck again. That's okay. And I will. This deeper part, as you begin to see what we mean by refuge in Dharma, Buddha knowing Dharma, or awareness of the way things are. And then obviously it takes patience, because that memory is going to keep coming back. That's what memory does. It gets triggered by things. But each time I see it with contact. So contact is not just like touching things, it's mental images. So with contact as condition, there's feeling. And with feeling as condition, there's craving. With craving as condition, there's attachment, upadana. And upadana is the whole nine yards of old age, sickness, and death, and birth, and storylines. And you can constantly break that. And you can see with some memories, it's really hard to break. Like if you really got betrayed by someone really cruelly, you know, and it takes a long time, sometimes takes a long time to forgive. But you don't have to forgive, you just have to feel the memory, and then eventually you can forgive. But if you feel that memory, it'll be very powerful, very painful, very, very painful. You can't get around that, can you? Just the way it is. And so if you have the sense of being able to witness and bear with, like forbearance is important, because a lot of life is not fair. You bear with it, it goes through you, and you don't make any more bad karma around it. You don't, you know, write speech, write action, and try not to run the storylines. They run. But then you resolve it. You resolve it that way. And why do you resolve it? Because otherwise it tortures you, doesn't it? So it's not even, you know, it's even nothing about even the other person. It's just what your own heart wants to be liberated from that kind of toxic stuff. Yeah. So moving along, ladies and gentlemen. This is that complicated one. Yeah, I think I won't go to this one. I suggested around. I didn't want to get too doctrinal. All right, shall we call it a night? Sorry.
Andamayang dhammakatha sadhukarang dadamase sadhu.